concepts are behind them. And on top of that, they're not physicists. So we all in this room are a minority, not just because we're women, but just because we're physicists at all. Most of the students who go through our first year physics programs are in biology or chemistry or any other sort of field, and a very small portion of them will actually continue on in physics. So what can we do about this? So first of all, we need to restructure the way that we hold undergraduate labs, and mainly refocusing them, shifting the focus away from these cookbook recipes, and moving more towards skills that they're going to be able to use in whatever field they decide to go into later on. And one way that we've been trying to do this is through invention activities. So an invention activity is an activity that we'll give out to students where they basically have to invent or create a solution to a problem before they've ever been taught how they might do that. And I'm going to give some examples later on. And in this case, when we say invention, I'm not talking, they're not building things in the lab with these inventions. We're mostly talking about mathematical formulas in this case. So the way that this works is we give students the invention activity. They work through this problem. They invent a solution. Most of the time, they get it wrong because obviously they're not expert physicists. They're not expert mathematicians. They're not going to invent this right formula in an hour or half an hour. But then we give them the traditional direct instruction that you would get if you were learning this formula in a classroom, and then you give them some practice problems or some way to implement, try out the formula that they've now learned. And studies have been shown that using this process as opposed to just the traditional instruction followed by the practice was shown by Schwartz and Martin in 2004. Don't worry about the embedded resource thing, that's a whole other thing. But they were able to significantly outperform the students who were in the traditional tell and practice conditions in sort of transfer tasks, so being able to apply the concept to a new situation. A group at UBC were implementing inventions in biology courses as well, and that's a whole other type of invention that I can talk about later on if you're interested. But they were able to show that in other problems, transfer tasks, students came up with more solutions, and they also came up with higher level solutions when they were doing these activities. And then some work that we did last year, we actually started structuring their thinking process as they work through the activities. And when we were able to do that, we showed that students who got this extra support came up with higher level comments, explanations about the inventions that they were coming up with, and then focusing on features of the data as opposed to other things like units and the numbers should be about this size, that kind of stuff. So I'm going to give you an example of an invention activity, and I'm going to do this using a program that I built as part of my master's thesis, which we called the iLab. And I'm not going to focus on the system itself. I do want to teach you about invention activities. So just a quick motivation about why we put it on the computer. So it has a lot of benefits to put it for in class compared to just having the activities on paper, especially that invention activities are very non-trivial to implement in a classroom. It's really hard to sit and watch the students struggle through these activities and not just sort of spoon feed them and give them. Marjorie's nodding her head. She was an instructor for the course that we do this in, and so she knows lots about that. So this will hopefully be an easier way to just pick these up and put them in new classrooms, transfer them to new situations without people having to learn all the theory behind it. Students can then work independently. They get guidance embedded in the activity, so you don't have to worry about how much you're telling them in the classroom. It's easy to create new activities, and then it also helps us move towards paperless labs. And then as an experimentalist, it gives us a lot of information about how students are working through the activities, what sort of reasoning processes are going on. And then it also helps us to randomize students into different conditions so we can test some neat things out on them. So how do you create an invention activity? So what goes into this? So first of all, you have to start with a goal. So in this situation, this is the fuel consumption activity where students are given four contractors, and they're told they're trying to measure the fuel efficiency of the same vehicle, which was 50 kilometers per liter. But they all did it obviously very differently, so the students had to come up with a way of quantitatively assessing which one was better or worse, which basically means you're inventing the slope, the uncertainty in the slope of the line. So they need to come up with this formula. And then from there, we give them data. And you'll notice that some of these things are red and some of these things are black. And that's sort of the red is the bare minimum what needs to go into invention activity. Black are things that we think are better, things that we've shown to be better. So we change each of the features explicitly. We have contrasting cases. So these are our contrasting cases in this case, where each of the features of the problem are changed each time. So I'm going to get you to think for a second. If you compare A and B, what do you notice in 10 words or less, what's different about the two graphs? Anyone? Sorry? So what's different about the data in this case compared to the data in this case? Absolutely. So contractor B took data that was further out away from the origin. They knew that at zero it's not going to run if it has no fuel in it. So they decided to take more data further out as opposed to close in at zero. And what about A to C? A lot more data points. So obviously we all know that if you take more measurements, you're going to get a more certain result. And then A to D. Pardon? Exactly. So you want the points to be, you're going to get a more accurate measurement if all of your points are close together. You're going to be more certain about the measurement that you have. So we get students to compare each of these, A to B, A to C, A to D, and explain why that's better. So why does it matter that they took the measurements further out or took more data? And then they rank them so that they get the things in the middle. And just to so that you know, this is the correct formula for the slope uncertainty. And so obviously the students wouldn't get this at this point. They would come up with things themselves. But you'll notice that at the bottom they can explicitly, you can explicitly see that there's leverage, so the x values on the bottom. You divide by n so that you take into account the number of points, and then you look at the vertical residuals of the data that way. So the next part of it is to actually invent a formula. So we've built an equation editor in Flash to go in here so they can actually build a mathematical formula and visualize it and see the variables and such. And then they also explain the formula itself. Why did that work? Compare it to the qualitative observations that you made earlier. So that they're actually thinking about this process and not just coming up with something. They're actually trying to reflect a little bit as they go through this. And then they implement the formula. So we get them to go to a spreadsheet software or calculators or whatever they want to use. And they plug in their formula using the data that we've provided to them, and they come up with the uncertainty for four different contractors. And then they do a ranking, and then they can upload the file so that we can take a look at what they actually came up with. And so the reason we get them, we make sure that they actually plug in the numbers, is you might miss some of the quantitative aspects, technical aspects of the formula. So for example, if you're looking at the idea of the residuals, if you just take the differences between the point and the line and you don't square it, you'll notice that you'll get positives and negatives. Things will cancel out, but you might not realize that unless you actually go in and start plugging in all the numbers. And then the last thing, of course, is to evaluate the results. So they get this initial qualitative ranking and a final quantitative ranking, and then they're side by side, so they can easily see, did these agree or not, and then explain why or why not. So you'll see that a lot of this is very scientific. You start off with a goal, you develop some hypotheses, come up with some sort of model, test your model, and then evaluate it at the end. So it really is following a very scientific reasoning process as they go through these invention activities. And of course, we all know that a very big part of science is to collaborate. So we all have students working in pairs. Doing this on your own would be an unbelievably daunting task. So we get them to work in partners at the computer as they work through this. So what are we going to do with this? We've got lots of studies to do with invention activities, lots more to find out about how they work through these activities. So we're varying the levels of guidance in the system, trying to apply it to other courses, other fields, other instructors, make sure that it actually is transferable, generalizable. We're looking at the logging of the data to make sure that we can get some really fine-grained information about how they're working, how they're reasoning. We want to build a spreadsheet so that everything's embedded so they don't have to leave and come back, but just so that everything's in this nice package. And then somehow or other, we're still trying to figure out how on earth to actually assess their reasoning ability. So are they actually learning to think like better scientists, and how can we actually kind of quantify that? So in summary, I hope you all learn that labs can and should be more than just a cookbook. Invention activities are a good way to help students start working through this reasoning process, get them towards being scientists, and that the program will hopefully help get invention activities into classrooms. Thanks.
I was wondering on the statistics you showed in the beginning where they sampled some students who had done this type of learning and others.
Sorry,
in the beginning when you had like a group of students who'd been taught in one way and in the other. I was just wondering how many students were sampled in both groups?
In which? Oh, geez. Okay, which one?
Like that one, yeah.
Oh, I don't remember, Schwartz and Martin. I think that they did a couple of experiments. I know that they usually have over 100 students at one point. In our studies, we're always working with about 140 students in the classes that we have. So yeah, you try to get the numbers nice and big so that you can actually get some statistics out of it. But yeah, these are all significantly statistically significant differences. Sorry.